Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. A somber moment for the nation today as the House formally voted to send two articles of impeachment to the Senate. But the moment came with a familiar divide.
He will be held accountable. He has been held accountable. He has been impeached. He's been impeached forever. They can never erase that.
These delay tactics were self-serving, hypocritical, and discrediting. But they made an important admission. Some might even call it a concession. You proved a very big point. Democrats do not even believe their case was robust enough to win in a trial.
First, you had House Speaker Nancy Pelosi as she named the seven Democrats who will manage and prosecute the impeachment case against President Trump in the Senate. And then an hour later, Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy from the House floor. So we're at this historic juncture. How do we make sense of things? How do we weigh the charges and the countercharges in this highly charged moment in our history? Well, we are lucky enough to have someone in Studio 3 who can help us do just that, because he's got a view, honestly, unlike anyone else in the country. He's advised four presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton, been part of award-winning news teams, and he's the founding co-director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard Kennedy School, where he's a professor. David Gergen, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, TC.
Impeachment. The trial's moving forward now. We got some new information today. We got the managers. We got the vote to send it over. What is your biggest takeaway from today?
From today, I think the solemnity of the occasion. You know, we've been sort of, this has been sort of in the foreground and background, floating around in our minds now for a long time. And to some extent, I think that people began turning away and looking on beyond these impeachment and prosecution decisions. But today brought it all back and showed us we are in serious territory here. This is only the third time in the nation's entire history when we've had a trial in the Senate that to remove a sitting president. You know, the odds against the vote, the odds against removal, of course, are very, very high. But even so, at a moment like this, when new documents and new evidence is being showered upon us, you can't help but think these are serious times and they deserve to be taken with respect for the traditions of the office and a lot of tolerance for the degree to which tensions are so high and people are going to say things that are going to be outrageous, and we just sort of have to move right on through it and continue working with the essence of the case, and that is whether Donald Trump committed impeachable acts that deserve his ouster.
How serious are the stakes, David? How serious are they? How do we really get our minds around that?
Well, we would be in much, much safer territory if, in fact, we were repeating the Clinton impeachment of some years ago. That impeachment, as serious as it was, basically at the end of the process, the senators applauded the people who wrote the rules. There was 100-0 vote. There was a sense of the country coming together, and Clinton was able to continue governing. And actually, his numbers by the time he left office were up to 64% approval. So, you know, that did not tear the country apart. I think that this whole process, this impeachment and now the trial are going to tear further at the fabric that holds us together and I think make it harder for the country to heal. I think much people are going to be in this coming election in November, I think will look for candidates who can heal, whether the Democrats can find the right person who can also meet the other qualifications people have, I think is a big, big question at this moment. So there's good reason to be a somber. We can celebrate the fact that our checks and balances are working, but somber at the prospects for a country that's coming apart.
You know, as I thought about having you with your particular perspective and the breadth and the depth of that on air today, I kind of thought about, okay, what can we ask you that we can't ask other people who might sit in that chair?
You mean what was it like in Andrew Johnson's impeachment?
I trust that you were actually not there for that one.
I'll get these on.
Well, what kept coming back into my head was, how bad is it, right? There are a number of different things happening in the world, and it feels like we are in a moment where we are unmoored or unanchored from a deep gut-level ability to compare that to previous experience and process things as they're happening in terms of how bad is it. Yeah. So, for example, it does feel like we have a divide right now that is staggering. Mm-hmm. But we've been divided before. How bad is it?
Well, Doris Kearns Goodwin, you know, who's we're so privileged to have her in our midst here in Boston. You know, she argues that we're more divided now than we have at any time since the 1850s.
That's terrifying.
And of course, it is terrifying because, of course, that led to the war itself. I remember coming home from a Democratic and Republican conventions covering them in 2004 and telling my wife, after going to those two conventions and hearing how vituperative they were and how each side demonized the other, for the first time, I could begin to understand how this country had a civil war. Mm. There is that sense now that, you know the evidence that how many people now on each side would be very unhappy if their son or daughter married somebody from a family on the other side. That's the kind of prelude to a country that's no longer a united country. You know, there are people who seriously, if they could, would separate out again.
You have studied public leadership. In public leadership. So given what you just said, what is the moment demand of our public leaders?
I think that the moment demands of our public leaders that they go back to fundamentals, they stop making debating points, stop personalizing this, but rather try to help us get through it as a country and put the principles of unity and that think of the Constitution as our binding document and try to stick with the traditions. Frankly, my hope is that as perilous as his journey may be, I think that having the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court presiding over these proceedings in robes, John Roberts, a lot of pressure on him. But I think he will come to represent the symbol of the Constitution itself. He's there in that capacity.
He'll embody it.
Yes, he'll embody the Constitution. And to be fair to him, he's not my favorite justice. But nonetheless, I do think he's shown more respect for the traditions of the law and the traditions of the Constitution than an ideologue would. He has not been as ideological as I feared to say. And on the health care, the Obamacare case in particular, he tried to save Obamacare in effect because I think he felt it was being railroaded out. And that's why I'm looking to him symbolically as an important figure in this. We'll see how it goes.
Did the House respect the Constitution in the way it executed its role in this impeachment process? And is the Senate respecting the Constitution?
I thought the House, and Nancy Pelosi in particular, was wise to wait, that she didn't want to be stampeded into an impeachment proceeding. It was only when the evidence came out that of the phone call between Trump and the head of Ukraine, that the numbers on her caucus really started to rise, and in particular, new veterans in Congress decided on going. Having said that, I did not think the Democrats were as wise as they should have been in bringing the Republicans more fully into the process of how this was going to be carried out.
Could they have?
Yes, I think they should have, and I do not think that they did. Well, that the traditions have been that leaders sit down together and figure out what the rules are going to be, that people see witnesses, they have access to documents quickly. And I know there were reasons why the Democrats did not think the White House was stonewalling. So the blame doesn't entirely go on the Democrats. But I did think from the beginning there was poison in the system more than there should have been. And I think we still are facing that. And so the process, I thought the Democrats could have found ways to give the Republicans less room for saying this was being railroaded. And it would take away one of their main arguments against.
I want to pull some sound here that kind of supports that. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy criticizing Speaker Pelosi for delaying the proceedings, and he did this earlier today.
Instead of sending the articles of impeachment to the Senate for trial, Speaker Pelosi held them hostage in a failed play to gain leverage that she did not and would never have. In terms of concessions, she got nothing. No control. No moral victories. In other words, another failed strategy.
Obviously, you had said that you thought, maybe she was wise to take it slowly. So what did she gain by doing that?
Oh, okay. I think she was wise to take it slowly before they initiated the impeachment proceedings in the House.
I see.
I also think that, to my surprise, I was not in favor particularly of holding the articles back. I thought at the end she's going to have to turn them over. She's backed herself into a corner. And I didn't think that was very smart politically, frankly. It has actually turned out more promising so far. It's not resolved yet. But if she had sent the articles over immediately, I think she had no chance of getting witnesses. Now she has a chance because she's put the spotlight on this, and there are senators now, there are at least three senators who say they're open to the, to conversations about witnesses. You need four to bring that vote about. Nancy Pelosi was not in the position to get that done before. She's in a much better position to get it now. And also, nobody could have anticipated the kind of flow of new evidence that has come in that fortifies the case against the president, and I think will bring some freshness to this. There was a real danger in these proceedings. It would just be all over again. We're going to go hear the same things again and again and again. And now there at least is something to look forward to because there's all these documents and potentially more documents to come. So it turned out better for her, and I think she is going to get a fairer fight than she had before.
So as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, I'm having trouble imagining Mitch McConnell, who said recently that having to call additional witnesses doesn't show confidence in the House's case, and he doesn't want to do it until after essentially the cases have been presented. I'm trying to imagine how he – you said she backed herself in a corner.
Yes.
I'm trying to imagine how he backs himself out of that and allows witnesses – as you say, is now a possibility.
Well, he's, you know, to be fair to him, he has said all along what he stands for is the Clinton model of how to conduct this, and that is the decision on witnesses would be made during the trial, not before the trial.
But in the Clinton model, witnesses had at least opportunity to testify in the House.
No, exactly. I understand. I understand that difference.
But yeah, I figure you probably would.
Yeah, and, well, I mean, it's just common knowledge. So McConnell, if he loses the vote, and he might lose that vote, and, you know, four Republicans, five Republicans, you know, break. He can say, look, that's what I said in the beginning. We're going to have I trust the Senate to operate with that. On the other hand, if she gets no votes, if there are no Republicans who break, it's going to be a proof that, holding back the articles for those few weeks actually didn't amount to much, and it does look like a defeat for her.
Let's go back to you used the word, I think, stonewalling of the White House. How bad was it?
It was terrible.
And explain that.
Absolutely terrible. I don't think – look, I was there during Watergate and working in the Nixon White House, just a young kid. And Richard Nixon, of all people, had people go up and testify. He turned over – I mean, John Dean – that's where the John Dean story came from. He was allowed to go testify. And Richard Nixon had the documents sent over. What he refused to do was give over the tapes, the voice tapes, the audio tapes. Because that's where once they became public, he would be doomed. But he was really open to the rest of this, and so we learned a lot long before the tapes came out. The tapes, of course, were ordered by the Supreme Court, and I think there was a very real chance that had the Democrats waited and gotten to the court, they might have won in the court. Might have won in the Supreme Court. I think they had
If they had fought
Resistance to the subpoenas, and they would have been able to get Bolton and get Mulvaney and get others to go testify, and I think they would have eventually won that case. But it would have been a long time, and we might have gone all the way past the November 2020 elections.
You really think it could have been that long?
I don't think it easily could have been that long. I think the Republicans would have found all sorts of stalling tactics. And very importantly, it's not just a question of, you know, in many ways, this should be left up to the voters at the end of the day. But if you give the Russians an easy play from now through the election, there's going to be a lot more disinformation. The Russians are going to be hacking in a lot of crazy places and trying to distort the elections. Who else may try to come in? The North Koreans and the Iranians.
How are we giving the Russians an easy play?
Because the country is not mobilized to stop the Russians. And, you know, to learn, as we learned this week, which was stunning, that the Russians have hacked into Burisma, you know, the gas company in Ukraine, where Joe Biden's son was on the board and, you know, made a fair swatch of money. What were the Russians doing that if they were not trying to stir up our elections? They were looking for dirt on the Bidens. And maybe they're doing it to try to help their friend Donald Trump. Who knows?
It's
so suspicious that the Russians would be hacking Burisma.
And so that's another one. I mean, I just keep coming back to this. How bad is it we know the Russians have been trying to tamper with our elections?
I think it is unbelievably bad if you have a country that is not going to believe in the credibility of the vote. That is just – that can really rip apart a democracy because people think if the whole system is indeed rigged and it's rigged in favor of our Russian friends, quote, that is going to be extremely disquieting. And I do think that getting this behind us and being able to move on to focusing more fully on ensuring we have fair elections is important. We've been waiting all the way through the election year and then – and discovered after November, or here's my nightmare scenario, and that is on election day, three or four critical states will have breakdowns in their voting systems, and they'll be unable to resolve who won. You can't go to the Electoral College because you don't know who's got because you got three or four states outstanding. And the president says, well, in light of that, I'll just stay. I'll stay until this is resolved. That would put the country – we would just come unglued.
Talk about a constitutional crisis.
But that's my nightmare.
All right. So now that none of us are going to sleep tonight after you laid out that nightmare, how do we make sure as a country that nightmare doesn't happen in November 2020?
Well, one of the first big things you would assume if the White House was serious about it is that you would bring to Washington the heads of the election units across the country, the representatives of the states, and bring in your technologists and see what can be done on a rapid basis to make sure that this election is not penetrated by others. And, I just don't think we're taking it seriously enough.
And if the White House doesn't take it seriously and do what you just said, is there any other body that can so that the steps that need to be taken still
We have what's called a Federal Elections Commission, FEC, and that's supposed to be the watchdog for us on election procedures. Well, guess what? The government, the president, hasn't appointed the members, and we have a body that doesn't have enough. I don't think they've got a quorum at the FEC. It's going to be basically a toothless watchdog.
Could Congress get busy on that and fill
absolutely.
Up the FEC in the next couple of months?
We should be. What we know is that democracies around the world, including ours, are now under existential threat. Country after country. I'm a big fan of a book called Why Democracies Die. It was a book written by two Harvard professors. It's short, it's accessible, and it's a very, very fine work. But they point out that since the end of the Cold War, a dozen major countries had democracies. They elected strongmen. The strongmen took them down to authoritarianism. We see that in Turkey and Poland and Hungary. You can go down the list. But the fact is the United States is one of the strongest democracies, but even we are now having real problems with our politics and the lack of faith, the crumbling faith in the system itself. And I think that's one of the great dangers of a second Trump term. One hopes that if he were reelected, he would be more sensible than that. But who can tell?
Do you believe the system can survive this?
I think I do think in the long term. I happen to be a short-term pessimist, but a long-term optimist.
I'll take it. That's David Gergen. He was an advisor to four U.S. presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. And he's the founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School, where he is a professor. Thank you so much for joining
us. Tiziana, thank you very much.
Great to have you.
Thank you.
Hey, stay tuned. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and this is Radio Boston.